time to pick up your flashlight and rusty pipe, as in this episode, we dive into the world of survival horror. We'll be talking about our favourite examples of the genre and quizzing the creator of Crow Country about what makes a horror game tick. So be brave and listen on. This is the PlayStation Access Podcast. Hello and welcome to the PlayStation Access Podcast, the official podcast of PlayStation UK. I am your host, Rob Pearson, and I am joined today by Rosie Caddick.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a very special guest today. We have Adam Vian from SFB Games joining us. Adam,
hi.
What a pleasure it is to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here.
This is great. What a pleasure.
Adam, we're going to talk a little bit later on about your new game that you've got coming out, Crow Country, which... Mm-hmm. Rosie, you've been playing and...
I've been playing a lot of it.
I have been looking at it. It looks really amazing. But before we get into that, I just wanted to sort of ask you a little bit about your journey to where you are today.
And I got the train from Paddington.
Oh, we've got a comedian on the podcast.
Such an obvious joke. Let's get out of the way, come on.
But the first thing I want to ask is, you set up the studio with your brother. Mm-hmm. What's it like making games with your brother?
It's great. We're very lucky. We have like this perfect kind of setup that we were just born into, I suppose. So my brother Tom is a programmer and I'm an artist. And so, yeah, it's like very convenient because those are the two sort of, maybe you could, there are a lot of people that make games by themselves, but generally speaking, you need some programming and need some art. So we were just kind of came packaged ready. Tom has a background in like, you know, physics and tech, and I do a lot of art and writing and design, so it's like a perfect little match. And the other thing that really helps is that we have all the same influences and taste, because we grew up playing, you know, the exact same games. So we just tend to agree on creative direction and what kind of stuff we want to make, and it's very smooth sailing.
Sounds like an amazing setup. Do you ever, surely there must be the occasional bust up though, right?
I mean, I'm trying to think what it would be. Honestly, no. Maybe we've got it coming. Maybe we're overdue. We have different tastes now, but like we appreciate the same kind of core principles. So it's never really been a problem. We've made games with other people as well, like, you know, but we've made hundreds of games together. So at this point, it's like a well-oiled machine, I would say.
And did making games, was it always a thing that both of you wanted to do growing up? Obviously, we'll get onto the influences behind Crow Country later on. And I think they'll be fairly apparent to anyone, especially like Rosie, who loves PS1 era survival horror. But obviously, it's quite obvious that you and your brother played those kind of games together as kids. Did you talk about making games when you were older? Like, where did that come from?
I don't know at what point I realized... that was a job. When you're a kid, you don't think about it. You just think video games just suddenly exist one day. we were talking before, like PlayStation 1 demo discs used to have games from the NetEuroze system, which was the kind of...
Rosie's vibrating over there.
It was the publicly accessible dev kit for PS1 that you could buy. And so I think that might have been one of the first times I learned, you could theoretically make your own game. You know, but we never did that, but we were aware of it. And then we started doing stuff for browsers, like in the Flash games.
Yeah. So that's what SFB stands for, right? Flash Bros.
Super Flash Brothers. And I used to make animations and with Flash. So yeah, Flash, you can make animations, you can make games, a bit of everything. And so one of our first animations was a parody of Smash Bros. So we were the Flash Bros, because we used Flash and we were brothers.
So it makes sense.
Super Flash Brothers is what we were called on the internet for many years, and it was fine. And back then there was no kind of copyright issues or anything, so we just shrugged. And then when we formed a proper company, we were like, I think it's time to just go with the acronym and not mention ever again what it stands for.
Oh, sorry, I brought it up.
No, it's fine.
It should have been
like real ones know. You know, real ones know, but it's not something we bring up. Like, hey, by the way, we're referencing two other companies' properties in our little acronym. So. It's just what it is.
That's amazing. So I wanted to ask you then, for people who may not have heard of Crow Country or completely new to it, how would you pitch the game to someone who doesn't know anything about it?
I would generally describe it as a classic style survival horror. And I would say it's for people who love old school survival horror, and it's also a very good gateway survival horror for people that are curious but haven't actually dived in. So if I can sort of have both those pillars at the same time, maybe that's a bit greedy, but I think it's very accessible as a first-time horror, but also should please old school fans. And it's set in 1990 specifically in an abandoned theme park called Crow Country. So that's why it's called Crow Country. You explore an abandoned theme park, it's been shut for 2 years, and you break in and you're looking for the owner who's disappeared. So that's the kind of story setup. And it's a mystery, thriller, horror, survival, adventure game with everything that you'd expect to see and that kind of thing.
And Rosie, you've been playing it. We're not going to talk specifics about it. It's not time to talk about anything story-wise in the game yet. But as a fan, Rosie, of this era of game, and in particular survival horror, I'm just keen to sort of like, I want you to talk to each other about this game, basically.
Like, I just saw Adam getting ready, being like, all right, what have you got to say about our game?
Terrifying.
So I personally have been absolutely loving it. When I started playing it, I got a few hours into it. And then I said to my boss, I was like, I'll carry on playing it. You know, when you've just got that hook on something. I was like, I'm hooked on the mystery, what's going on. And I think what you said about it being a really good introduction, as well as being great for those who already know the genre, is absolutely, I completely agree with that. You've done loads of things to make it more accessible, be it having the mixture between tank controls and then also more modern style controls.
Yeah.
Literally just, you don't even need to change the settings. Just
yeah, they're both there at the same time. I thought I'd invented that, and then I realized I'd taken it from something else.
Always
but,
the way.
But either way, or even the fact that you've got little like memos and gameplay tips that whenever you find a document, you can access them at any time from the beginning of the game, even to the ones you've recently found, like in your little safe rooms. I just think that's really accessible, rather than think, I forgot what that memo is. I have to try and remember not only where it is.
Yeah, yeah. We're trying not to be kind of old school harsh. And a lot of older games were just like, you know, get good. You're supposed to get stuck on it. You're supposed to play this for weeks and weeks and weeks. We're trying to add modern quality of life. Stuff so that a modern audience will not hate the game,
but you've also got a really healthy balance of challenge, I find, as well. As I've been playing more of it, it's got a lot more tougher as it's progressed, but that's what I'd expect as well. You don't play Resident Evil and then just have zombies, you get the hunters coming in and everything else.
I actually think about that exact moment quite a lot. Without the hunters, Resident Evil 1 would be boring after the halfway point, it would be. Exactly.
Like, the hunters, what made me really appreciate like the horror and survival horror specifically in video games. That's why I was like, this is how it works. And playing through Crow Country, first of all, you see a couple more enemies popping up here and there, but then you get some jump scares, and some of them have got me. I've fully just been like, and then, you know, when you panically get your gun and you're just trying to aim.
I love jump scares. They get a bad rep these days, but they're great.
It's great fun.
What do you think makes a good jump scare, Adam?
I just make it meaningful, and the timing is everything. So the best jump scares happen right after you've decided there is not going to be a jump scare.
Right.
So I try and position them like right when you're feeling good about yourself.
And are these the kind of things you like play test? How do you test whether or not you've got a jump scare right? Are you like, you know, either you or Tom make something and you get the other one to play it, and you're like, you know, how and you're gauging how each other reacts?
I honestly didn't do that much iterative testing on that kind of stuff. Like, I just kind of hope for the best, just hoping my intuition is enough to carry me across. And I will tweak stuff if I see people interacting with it in a way that I'm not happy with.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of that has just been the stuff in the demo, because the demo's been out and I've been watching YouTube videos about it. You know, I see people do it Let's Plays and stuff. But the rest of the game is kind of no man's land. Like, I've watched a few people play it, but not, you know, 100 people play it. So I'm just hoping for the best at this point.
So what's it like being in this stage then, Adam, where you've the majority of the work on the game is done and you're sort of waiting. You're waiting for people to play it.
It's very surreal.
It must be nerve-wracking, right?
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking. It's like, you know, the true horror is being perceived by others. So
that's the inspiration for the next game.
Yeah.
Perceived by others.
The game. Yeah, that's where I'm at now, where I'm like, oh, well, you actually have to show your game to people? I thought I could just make it and play it myself. So that's happening right now. You know, people are playing it for review and stuff, which is terrifying, because I'm just like, I'm convinced that there's something wrong with it. It's not going to work. It has been tested. I'm just, you know, I'll never lose that anxiety of, oh no, I forgot to do something, or it's too easy, or it's too hard. So Rosie, hearing you say that, you know, you're enjoying the challenge, that's very reassuring.
No, I genuinely think that as well, even the elements of survival horror where you've got ammo scarcity and things like I have had moments where because in the game you do very fairly give the tip saying you don't have to kill every enemy,
right? No, that's up to you.
But which isn't, yeah, with these kind of games it is entirely up to you.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was really nice you put that warning. But I am getting to the point of the game that even though I think I've been quite preserved with ammo, you put us in situations where sometimes but you have to use it, as you said, more enemies are like spawning around and stuff. So again, with the challenge, not only is it naturally getting more tricky, but even when you think I've been good with my ammo,
right.
I'm finding at the moment that I'm having to use my shotgun a bit more now, for example.
Okay.
So
I'm glad you even have the shotgun. That's good.
Yeah, I got the shotgun.
Very important.
And I got the Magnum. I was very happy.
Oh my God, you got the Magnum. The shotgun is designed to show up just as you're getting annoyed with how weak the handgun is.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, thank goodness. Well done for getting the Magnum. That's very secret.
Yeah, you're speaking to a pro gamer here,
honestly,
Rosie.
Yeah,
like,
stuff,
she knows what she's doing.
I mean, you say that, but I've got the map where you can see the secrets, and I do some crosses and stuff.
Great, yeah.
The Mushroom King. I was with the Mushroom King for ages, and I've eaten the mushrooms. I'm just like,
yeah, good.
I've done this, but now what?
That puzzle is deliberately baffling. If you were baffled, tick. Good.
So I need to figure out what the stage is after that.
There is some stuff in the game that I'm looking forward to being like playground rumor stuff, where once everybody is playing it, they can go, oh my gosh, did you know what this is? Oh, I heard the rumor that it's this. I've tried this. I've tried that. So there's definitely some stuff in the game that is designed to be slightly confusing on the first time through. And maybe you look it up or you ask someone else. So yeah, there's a mixture of stuff like that.
We were talking a little bit about that kind of experience when we were playing Dragon's Dogma 2 recently, which is another game that I really enjoyed in its approach to not spoon feeding you solutions to things. And it made me realize that I haven't really been stuck on a game.
Yeah.
Probably since I was a kid, for like, yeah, you know,
well, it's
25
changed.
Years ago. Like,
it used to be that you were designed, you were supposed to get stuck.
Yeah.
And now you're not, very specifically, not supposed to get stuck.
So you mentioned earlier about wanting to preserve the feeling of a retro PS1 title, but also add in those mod cons that gamers expect in a game in 2024.
Right.
So like, how do you approach that? Because I really enjoy that experience of chatting to my friends in the playground when I was a kid, playing games like Final Fantasy VII, and someone was like, "Ooh, I know how you can bring Aerith back to life," and all this kind of all of this kind of thing, stuff that wasn't true, but I love that kind of discussion. And nowadays I feel like, you know, it's all there online immediately after games have released, and you can look everything up and you can find a solution to anything you want. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on how you approach that and how you balance that, because obviously it feels very much like you've been inspired by that PS1
year. I mean, it's not that I want people to get stuck and stop playing specifically, but if they do, that's okay, I guess. There's lots of hints around you're rewarded for being observant and investigative, because there's hints everywhere, visual hints, written hints, diagrams you can look at, just general kind of visual communication. So the game rewards you if you're paying attention, and the puzzles will become easier. It also has a little bit of a non-linear path in a way, where if you get stuck on a puzzle, it's probably something else you could go and do. So that helps with that. It means it's okay to get stuck briefly because you've got something else to do. I call it the Elden Ring factor.
The Elden Ring factor. Well,
the Elden Ring is the easiest FromSoft game because if you find a boss too hard, you can just go do something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas the other games, not so much. It's not actually like that, but you know what I mean? It's the equivalent. Apart from that, just testing people, playing the game, trying to get it just right where you feel smart for solving the puzzles. And you don't feel like the game is spoon-feeding you stuff, even though it pretty much is. It is a really hard balance to get right. And everyone's different. And I've watched people play the demo where they run through every room and ignore everything. And then maybe they're confused. And then I've watched people play and they read every note and they write it down and they stress about it. They read a memo and they're like, oh no, I'm going to have to remember every word of this memo. And it's like, so it takes, you know, everyone's different.
I'd love to sort of pick your brains about various aspects of survival horror as well. And I remembered interviewing Shinji Mikami many years ago at E3. I think it was around about the time when The Evil Within first came out.
Okay, yeah, sure.
And I asked him what makes the perfect survival horror protagonist, expecting some kind of like, you know, deeply profound answer from Shinji Mikami. And he just looked at me and said, "You are weak, but you've got a gun."
That's exactly
that was what he said. So I'm keen to, what are your thoughts on the perfect survival horror protagonist?
That is pure poetry. Like, the reason I prefer third person horror is because I want to see the little guy on screen and I want to worry for their safety. So "you're weak and you have a gun" is perfect because it's like, yeah, you want to see the vulnerability of them. Generally, they're very human, more than your average protagonist. Survival horror is like, hey, you play as a person. Generally, otherwise it becomes Devil May Cry, right? That's the difference. That's quite literally the difference.
I mean, that happened. That literally happened, right?
That's why Resident Evil 4 became Devil May Cry. Is they're like, this guy's too cool. He's not human. he's got a sword. He can't die. This isn't survival horror anymore. Mm. Even if he picks up a rusty key, we don't care. It's not survival horror anymore. So yeah, some of my favorite horror games are very much, I mean, Clock Tower 3 and Haunting Ground are two games where you don't fight back at all. Rule of Rose is a third one in that group, where you don't fight back, you are pathetic, and all you can do is just run and hide and survive. And maybe there's a gun like at the end of the game, but it's secret or something. I love that. It's so cool to play as a hopeless, weak individual.
Whilst hearing nothing but Alyssa, like just charging at you and everything. Exactly.
So Rosie, you must have played a bunch of these games as well. Like, do you prefer to have a gun or do you like the running and the hiding?
I like a mixture of both. I love ones where you do have a weapon, and I also love ones because I feel that when you have a weapon, it's not as if you're got endless ammo or anything like that. When you've got a weapon, like you said with the handgun, they are, for example, they're weaker or you've got limited ammo. Yes. So it still adds that sort of threat of, do I attack? Do I use this weapon? Do I save the Magnum for something later on or now?
Yeah.
So there is still that survival fear for how they've brought weapons into it. But I also do agree, I do love the like Clock Tower 3. I remember when I first played that and I was terrified because I think that was actually one of the first instances where I thought, I don't have a weapon. And it's not as if, you know, sometimes when you play a game and you're like, I don't have a weapon, so nothing's going to attack me at this point. It's not that at all in those style games. You don't have a weapon. All you can do is hide and get your stress meters down. Otherwise, you're going to be fumbling and stumbling around. I mean, I'm referring to Clock Tower 3 specifically in this moment, but I think it's good definitely to have both of them. I think they're both really good.
I always think a horror game is working well if you have a gun and you have limited ammo. You want to shoot your gun, but you should feel bad every time.
Yes.
Because you're like, oh, was that the right moment to waste a bullet? So that's what's good about them.
Which is what you guys have also done in Crow Country. The amount of times I've gone to open a box.
Yeah.
And then, you say in the game, don't always guarantee there's something going to be in those boxes.
You may have wasted a shot.
And the amount of times I've done that and I'm like...
It's just funny how it's a genre that thrives on making you feel bad and anxious because that's quite unusual, I would say.
Or say if you are using the handgun, you can use 8 bullets on an enemy or 2 shotgun bullets.
Right.
And then you're not only feeling bad, but you're like, did I approach that in the best way? Mm-hmm. Like, I completely get what you mean. And especially as well, if you miss a bullet.
Oh, it's the worst
depressing
feeling.
Yeah. That's just sad.
The zombies in Resident Evil, also, they're just like perfectly designed to like shamble from side to side.
Oh, the ones in remake.
You're trying to get a bead on their head and they're just like, and you just unload a whole clip into thin air and it's just, is there a worse feeling in video games than missing a zombie in Resi 5 times? I don't know.
The important thing when you do that is to keep playing and not reload, because the feeling you get afterwards is key to the experience.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where the survival bit comes in, right? It's like, I've completely ballsed that up.
Yep.
How am I going to get out of this situation
and,
now?
And most horror games, Crow Country included, will have a secret algorithm that gives you ammo if you need it.
Oh, interesting.
Like, in Resident Evil 3, the original I played recently, I ran through a corridor, picked up some herbs and some ammo, and then died. And then I did that section again, but I did something else first, and the herbs and the ammo were not there.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, right, it's you know, there's an algorithm in place.
I had that with Crow Country with one of your vending machines, yep, where I was kicking it and nothing appeared. And then I died. And I think I was like, oh, I'll explore somewhere else, use some ammo. Mm-hmm. And then magically that same vending machine, I was I see what you
sometimes
did there.
Sometimes you can spot it when video games are taking pity on you.
One of the issues with Crow Country is that you use the gun for puzzle interactions.
Yes.
So I actually couldn't have a situation where you can fully run out of ammo forever because you would be soft locked. So I had to be like, okay, yeah, vending machines, maybe the trash cans, maybe the car. There has to be ways to get ammo, but it should only give it to you if you need it.
Yeah.
So that you're always thinking, I'm running out. Oh, thank goodness there's a bit more. I'm running out. And that's the kind of ebb and flow. And you just have to tweak it endlessly until you feel like it's right.
Which it does do brilliantly. I mean, another example, I had no handgun bullets, so I was using the shotgun for a bit, and I went into a bin and I was like, please, please let this bin have handgun. And then I got like the sound of like, doo-doo-doo, and I was a banana peel. Oh. And I was like, it's because I had shotgun and magnum. I was just being stubborn.
The
I was
game like, is like, you don't need this. Yeah, fine,
I was like, I don't want to use my shotgun right now. I want to use my handgun on these like little ones that crawl on the floor.
That's the worst thing, is wasting a really strong bullet on a weak enemy like that. That's not.
I find this stuff fascinating, though, because it suggests to me that you have a figure or a number in your head for the amount of ammo you want a player to have, the ideal amount of ammo that you want a player to have at any one time, to maximize that feeling of uncertainty, of anxiety when it comes to using it. So, like, you know, what is that number? What are you aiming for at all times?
I think in Crow Country you can have 40 handgun shots because you can have 32 in the box and 8 in the gun. So that's 40. And I want people to be around 10 to 12 because that's one fight and then you're in trouble.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I want people to be floating at. And, you know, it depends on how good of a shot you are. If you stand closer to the enemies and shoot them in the head, they'll go down in 4 shots, 5 shots. If you try and snipe them from a mile away and miss the head, you're looking at 8 to 10.
Yeah.
So that, you know, massively depends on, but the algorithm will fix it basically for you eventually.
Yeah.
If you keep playing, it'll be like, oh, you run out here some more.
So I just find it fascinating to think about you making that, because it's not often we get to speak to people who actually make these games and make these kind of decisions about, okay, when should we give the player ammo? Where should they be able to find it? And I know you mentioned you're sort of like, you know, more of an artist and your brother's like the programmer. How do those two disciplines meet when you're trying to make decisions like this about sort of like the cadence of when you're dropping ammo and
it's really
and
just
first
like,
aid packs?
It's
and
just playing it over and over again and writing down notes on how you feel at every moment. So I would do playthroughs when it was quite young. It was quite early on. And I'd be like, I have too much ammo now. I write down where I was in the game, and or the opposite, I've got none and I'm in trouble, write that down. And then I would just add a tiny bit or take away a tiny bit until it sort of leveled out, basically. So it's just iteration. There's no kind of rule you go into it with, because I don't know how much bullets, I don't know how many bullets you need in Crow Country, I have no idea. But you just play it until it feels right, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it is that feeling, isn't it? I guess it's so much that feeling, because I rarely, when I play Resident Evil, but this does sometimes happen, I'll find myself just really stacked, just really loaded. I have a shotgun, I've got a briefcase absolutely overflowing with additional ammo.
Mm.
And you're right, you do sort of lose.
Yeah.
You walk into a room thinking, come on then, like I'm definitely surviving this room.
It's interesting, isn't it? If you're really thorough and careful in a horror game, you will end up with too much ammo.
Mm.
And it stops being stressful, but that feeling is replaced by a different feeling, which is accomplishment. And now you feel good for a different reason, which is that, oh, I'm really prepared. So it's like one or the other. Both feel good in a way. The worst thing is when you stack up supplies. Like this happened to me at Dino Crisis 1. I had all the guns, all the ammo, everything ready for a boss fight that just never happened. And I finished the game and I'm like, I literally saved all. It's like the Mega Elixir joke, you know?
Yeah.
Mm. Like, I might need it for a boss. This is the boss. No, I might need it for the next boss. So that's the worst. So I try to give people, you know, lots of reasons to shoot the gun.
Another key element to survival horror games, particularly of this era, is the setting. I mean, Rosie's right now wearing a Raccoon City Police Department jumper. You'd be hard pressed to argue that that's not the most iconic survival horror setting of all time.
I agree. easily.
What are your thoughts on the setting? And I guess, why did you choose a theme park? What was it about the theme park for Crow Country that you thought, okay, this is going to be our setting?
I mean, first of all, the two best settings in horror survival are Resident Evil 1 and Resident Evil 2. And so it's a mansion or it's the police station, right? And they're kind of functionally similar. But the thing they have in common is they're both human domestic spaces where the rooms have meaning. They're lived in. You know, everything is real. There's a bathroom. There's a kitchen. You know, you can see evidence of human activity. Maybe they're gone now for various reasons, but they feel like real spaces. And video games that just take place in like, oh, it's a temple and there's endless brick corridors, they're less interesting by default. So I wanted a space that felt real and human and somewhere you might, you know, that would be interesting to explore from a story perspective and a human perspective. So I went with a theme park. There is a theme park in the beginning of Silent Hill 3, which is my favorite horror game of all time. So I probably was inspired by that.
I was wondering if there was like that inspiration there.
I haven't played that one in a while. I'm saving it, but I'm sure it subconsciously lodged itself in there as like, oh, this is a top five place to set horror game. So when I started, I just wanted a location that was juicy. And I just mean like a location that very easily gave ideas out for themed rooms, you know? So with a theme park, you've immediately got, oh, well, you've got an ocean themed area and a Halloween themed area and a fairy tale themed area or something like that. So that's like great, easy. The rooms can have variety. It's not all going to be the same. And then within those spaces, it's really easy to dream up like interesting, memorable spaces, whether they're attractions or it's a theater or it's an animatronic. So it was just a good like starting point for idea generation, basically. But specifically, I've said this before, the reason it's in a theme park is because it's my lifelong kind of dream is, so I went to Disneyland a lot as a child and I always loved Pirates of the Caribbean and Small World and any of the dark rides. And I just thought that for some reason, the idea of being allowed to wander around in the back areas behind the animatronics or in the control room, because you're Disney specifically, you're very much not allowed to see any of that stuff.
Yes.
They keep it super secret. And it's like this forbidden fruit for me of like, I just want to see behind the show.
Oh man.
And so that feeling is why I made Crow Country. It's like, what if you were allowed to wander around a theme park and go in all the doors and poke around in the control rooms? And that's what you can
I love
do.
That kind of thing. I have a vivid, you've just unlocked a memory for me of riding Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
And I had this weird obsession with like not looking at what was in front of me, but I'd turn around and look behind me at the animatronics after they'd reset. After our boat had gone past, the animatronics reset, the lights go off, and I'm just like, there's something really uncanny and unnerving about seeing them there, just like motionless.
You're looking through the veil.
Waiting for the next boat to just come along. Like, what happens there in that unknown dark space?
When I go on Pirates of the Caribbean, I my first thought is, this has been here the whole time. And the really specific thought I have is, this is here at night when no one is on the ride. Right, the idea that you're lying in your bed and the Pirates of the Caribbean are just standing there in presumably pitch black.
Oh.
And it's like, that's just an interesting thought.
It is.
So that's what Crow Country
is. It is terrifying. I think Small World probably is even...
Oh, sure.
There's this weird sort of like chirpy, happy, vibrant colourfulness to it. And the dissonance between, I guess, and this is true for the theme park as a setting as a whole, like a theme park is supposed to be a happy, fun place.
Yep.
And you're turning it into a dark and scary one.
The other thing I really enjoy is urban exploring. Not myself, I just watch it on YouTube. I don't want to get arrested. So I watch a lot of urban exploring on YouTube. And my favorite locations are theme parks. And there's a very famous one in Japan called Nara Dreamland, which has been demolished now. But it was nearly a Disneyland, but they lost the license. So it's this kind of knockoff Disneyland where nothing's quite right. It's Uncanny Valley theme park. Mm. And everything's slightly strange and slightly cheaper than you might expect it to look. And it became like the ultimate hotspot for urban exploring because it was shut down quite soon after it was opened. Mm. So everything was there. But, you know, nature came back and started to decay. And it's just so beautiful and weird, the idea of like decaying animatronics and things like that. there's a subcategory of this called submechanophobia, which is people that are obsessed with or scared of mechanisms like animatronics that are now submerged underwater, because that's a particularly harrowing experience for some reason. So there's a couple of bits like that.
Oh, I've never thought of that, but yeah, that is like...
Yeah, because they decay, the rubber melts.
Yeah.
Like it's very specifically, oh, I don't know, it's just, I don't know.
I guess it maybe taps into the sort of that thalassophobia or the fear of shipwrecks or the fear of seeing things underwater that shouldn't be there, just sort of like all
frozen
of a sudden,
in time, but also decaying. Yeah.
Oh, it's kind of terrible. Yeah, shiver down my spine just thinking about it. So we've talked about locations then. Obviously, the other big thing for survival horror, you've got to talk about the enemies that you face. Mm. So creating monsters to roam the theme park. What's the process like trying to create nightmare fuel, essentially? What for you makes a good survival horror adversary?
When they look human, but there's something wrong with them. And that does apply to zombies, but traditional zombies, we're all far too overexposed to them. They're super boring, right? I would say. So it's like that, but not your average Romero zombie, but something else, like where it has a face and you can see that it is thinking, or but it's not fully sapient.
So, yeah. Ooh, okay, yeah.
Because the scariest thing is like when you look at like an orangutan in a zoo or something and it can perceive you on a level that is slightly unnerving.
Yes.
Like like they have just enough intelligence to perceive you and think about you, but they're also monstrous. So a game with just like full-on snarling, roaring monsters is less interesting than a game with monsters that are, you know, weeping or mumbling because they're in pain or they're sad. Mm-hmm. So it's all about the human aspect of it. It's like, well, what is this? It feels human, but it's not human. That's uncomfortable to me on a base level, evolutionarily speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, so, you know, you mentioned then that you think, you know, we maybe have too many zombies nowadays. Like, sure. You know,
they don't mean anything anymore. They're just whatever.
Yeah, they're sort of just they're functional. They're very easy from like a moral point of view to just kill and not That's feel true. Bad about because they're already dead. So like, you know, I guess I'm excited to see sort of like what you cook up in the future in terms of like, you know, what monsters are going to be lurking out there. Just animatronic pirates, maybe. Talking about Pirates of the Caribbean. Another interesting thing about Crow Country is that you have included a combat-free exploration mode. Is that right?
That's right.
I'd love to just talk about your thinking behind that, because it's something that I have thought when I was playing Alien Isolation in particular. Mm. Man, I would love to just explore this game.
Right, that's exactly
and it. Look at the gizmos, look at the sci-fi stuff.
Mm-hmm. Without
the oppressive
by
the terror of constantly being hunted by a xenomorph.
Yeah, yeah. We've lost the tweet, but I found it. I read a tweet years and years ago from someone I don't know, and it said, "Does anyone have a mod that removes the monsters from Silent Hill? I just love being there, but I don't want to fight anything."
Yeah.
And I read that and I was like, that is so true.
Silent Hill is a great one for just looking around the environment.
So I thought there must be lots of people like this that would just want to be there and but wouldn't want to engage with, you know, shooting the enemies, getting killed, dying, whatever. So I thought, okay, instead of doing, you know, an easy mode, I'm just going to do a no combat mode. And then the game becomes a puzzle adventure game in its own right, which is a completely valid genre. It's not like it's missing something. It just becomes a spooky puzzle adventure game. And it's been a popular decision. Lots of people say, oh, thanks so much for including something like this because it looks really cool, but I don't play horror games. There's a lot of people who have just arbitrarily or not decided that they don't play horror games. They're too scared. They're too stressful. They're not good enough at them. They'll, you know, whatever it is. And that's fine. But we're basically saying, hey, you can play this too. And you'll get, you know, 99% of the experience because you'll still enjoy the story and the puzzles and the exploration and the atmosphere and everything except the actual act of firing your gun at enemies and worrying that they're going to chase you down and kill you.
Because that is the thing, even from me running around with the enemies around, you've definitely taken a really good atmospheric approach. Like the sound design when you go into all these different areas and everything seems to have its own unique sound to help build the theme park and the world and everything. So hearing, like already, I haven't tried the just the no combat mode, but already I'm thinking, oh, just to go through there and just purely listen to the sounds again.
Yeah, yeah. I think it might be a good thing to do when developing a game like this, is to say, okay, it needs to be fun without monsters first. And then if you add in combat, that's great. Like, my Silent Hill 2 is probably the best horror game ever made. And the best parts of that game are the empty rooms.
Yes.
So there you go. Right? Like, that's a proven formula.
But are those parts only good because
of the
expectation and the not knowing when you're next going to encounter a monster?
I suppose so. Like, I think you could still enjoy them without, but yeah, you're right. It is about worrying about being killed, I guess.
You mentioned sound there, Rosie, and that's obviously another massive, massive aspect of survival horror. In particular, I'm really fascinated by just the choices developers make when it comes to the sound of menus and confirmation sounds when you pick up an item.
Like right, right.
Resi Evil, I can just hear it. I can hear that kind of bloop,
yeah,
bloop, 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 bloop. Like, it's such a, it just sticks in your head. It's such a part of the fabric of the, oh my God, there we go. I was wondering when Rosie was going to break that out.
I was like, I'm just going to slide a little nemesis in there.
How do you approach sound design, music, effects for, you know, menu sounds, reloading sounds, all that kind of thing? And how much do you believe that plays a part in the overall experience?
It's a big part, but it's also the part that I'm probably the least accomplished at. Particularly UI sound effects is something that I'm really not that great at. I went along with it for a while, and then quite recently I redid all the UI sound effects in the game because I realized that they were disparate and I hadn't made a kind of identity for it. So I've done that now, and it's very specifically a mixture of kind of blurry bell sounds with old mechanical sounds. So I use 1980s typewriters and stuff to make clicking sounds, just because I wanted it to feel analog and old school and not too high tech or too sci-fi, because that, you know, it's storytelling as well in its own way, and it's
absolutely
the era comes across and all that stuff. But it's really, yeah, UI sound effects is difficult. I probably should have paid someone to do it for me, but I did not. That's okay. The ambient sound is something I enjoy a lot, because I do ambient sound in rooms by basically getting 10 different ambient tracks that I think could work. Like, oh, it's the sound of a filter or a fan or just some dark, you know, mumbling ambience. And then you just play with it and you fade up the pitch and the volume and the reverb, and you just play with it live until it sounds cool. So that's a process that I quite enjoy.
That sounds fun. I can imagine just sitting there just playing around with this stuff for hours on
end. And then, like, if you walk into a room and it feels right, then you got it right. If you walk into a room and it feels wrong, then you just tweak it and, yeah.
I really wanted to ask, just quickly, how do you come up with the safe, so let's just say the safe room music? Mm-hmm. Because it's... again, something I really like with Crow Country is how you can be in an area and it's just a room, but if you go a little bit forward, it suddenly becomes a safe space. And you can tell that the first thing you hear is the music, and it is that relaxing sort of tone, feeling at ease with the fire crackling as well.
I think save music is one of the most important things in a horror game. And if you go to like a YouTube video of the save music from any horror game, whether it's Dino Crisis, Resident Evil, Silent Hill, Silent Hill less actually, because there's no box. Anyway,
that's just like woo.
Yeah. Anyway, it'll be the music that people are the most attached to emotionally and have the fondest memories of, because it's that, you know, you're safe, but you're not safe. It's a moment to breathe and, you know, decompress and organize admin, like go through your items and reload and all that stuff. So it's really important. The music was all composed by a composer called Ockroyd, who did the music for Crow Country. And we set out to sort of make sure the save room theme was, you know, beautiful and mysterious and delicate and kind of sweet, where you're happy to hear it, but it also makes you a little bit sad. It was a balancing act, and I'm really happy with where we are now. That's a really important one to get right for sure. It's equally hard to get, like, the other music that's really hard to get right is encounter music. There's a horrible piece of music in the first enemy encounter in the hallway, and the track is called The Moans Choir, and it's horrendous, it's awful, but that's exactly what you need to make you feel stressed when the enemies show up. So that's, yeah, it's
especially on a first encounter as well. It's like, you're not just running around unless you go for the different game mode, but you're not just running around an abandoned theme park. It's
no,
there are things here,
right. So, yeah, there's all kinds of challenges with the soundtrack. I think the thing I'm most excited for people to discover in Crow Country is all the music, because it's really strong and really broad emotionally. And some of the music is really sweet. Some of it is almost funny. Some of it is horrendous. I think it's really strong. So I'm really looking forward to having people experience it. And we're going to have a soundtrack album and stuff as well. So
excited.
Oh, I do love a good video game soundtrack. Yeah. I know you do as well.
I like listening to the Signalis soundtrack. It's 56 tracks long. Most of them are just ambient, nothing. It's great.
Video game soundtracks for commutes and for reading.
Yeah.
Like whenever I'm reading a book, I have to pick. I need to find the soundtrack
just
for this book.
Go with the Hollow Knight soundtrack. You can't go wrong with that.
Oh, it's such a good one for like just relaxing too.
Yes.
Finally, on Crow Country, before we get on to some, I want to pick your brains about PS1 survival horror specifically. Visually, obviously, that's another massive element to creating the correct atmosphere. And from looking at the game, you know, visually, I can see like almost that classic Resi style. Grimy sheen across everything, like it looks like you know, it looks dirty. You know, what are your thoughts and how do you approach the visual style of the game?
I mean, the game just grew organically from nothing, so I never really set out with a design document of I'm gonna make a game that looks like this. I'm gonna, you know, it just happened as I developed it. It is grimy. So PlayStation 1 era games, especially like a modern indie making a PS1 era games, a lot of the time it's all about low poly, and Crow Country actually isn't really low poly. So instead of doing like low poly environments, I really like doing detail and texturing and shadows. And what happened is they accidentally ended up looking like pre-rendered artwork from Resident Evil 1, 2, or Final Fantasy 7. And that just came about when, you know, we were just doing particular types of modeling, particular types of texturing, where I just enjoyed adding detail. And then the character is the most low poly thing on the screen. And that's just to make them nicely visible and also just to keep them like appealing and simple. Like the character in Crow Country, she wears white and she's just like made of spheres. So she kind of pops against all the grimy like browns of the game. But we do have a special camera filter, and it is multifaceted and very complex. It's our secret sauce. And one day we'll explain exactly what it's doing, but it's doing about 20 different things.
Oh,
it literally crunches down the pixels and then grows them back up again and then crunches them down again. It's like we put the pixels in a kind of meat grinder and they come out the other end going through multiple filters. And there's a TV static on the whole thing so that it comes alive a little bit. Everything is colored brown ever so slightly. There's so many things that are happening to it. And basically, I made it by experimentation. And one day I just realized, oh, this looks really cool. It looks dreamlike and uncanny and like a PS1 game, but actually kind of its own thing as well. And ever since that day, I've just been like, okay, I'm just not going to touch this now. So I don't know how I did this.
Like a chef gradually adjusting and working on
a recipe.
A chef
that doesn't know what he's doing and just lucked on a dish that is kind of cool.
And then save it.
Yeah, could not recreate it from scratch. If you kidnapped me and told me to make the Crow Country filter in a new computer, I'd be like, no idea, mate. No idea what that is. I couldn't even begin.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, I love it. Well, Crow Country is coming to PS5 on the 9th of May. I think it looks fantastic. I'm really looking forward to diving in. As someone who typically is often too much of a coward to play horror games, I really love the look and feel of it. And it looks like, you know, I love the Resi thing when you've got a game it's scary, but it's so compelling. Like you've got that balance between how compelling is it, how scary is it, and the compellingness has to be just a little bit higher than the scares to constantly pull you through. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to diving in. I want to ask you now, Adam, just about your past with PS1 survival horror.
Yep.
And I'm hoping that you can bring out your secret bag of goodies.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Because I know Rosie's going to absolutely love this. So if there's anything, any answer to any of these questions that you think would warrant a look inside secret bag, sure. That would be amazing. And even if they don't, let's just bring out the bag.
Yeah.
So can you remember the first PS1 survival horror game you played?
Yeah, it was a demo for Silent Hill 1 and I hated it.
Was it the one that came with Metal Gear Solid?
Maybe.
By any chance?
The demo was the golden hand in the school. That doesn't mean anything, but yeah, it was on a, it must have been in a PlayStation magazine demo disc. That's what I had, And I just played it in passing when I was quite young, and I didn't like it at all. I didn't like Silent Hill. It gave me a headache. It was too dark. The camera was moving all over the place. I hated it. So I said, I don't like horror survival. And that's it. That's the end of it. So I didn't like those games. I think Silent Hill is maybe like a slightly tricky one to start with because it is slightly headache-inducing by design. And had I had Resident Evil, I might have enjoyed that more. Mm. But I didn't get into the genre until I had a GameCube and someone gave me Resident Evil 1 Remake, which I played. And I was like, oh, this is great. I love this now. And then I went back and played all the Silent Hills, 1, 2, 3, 4, back to back. And I was, you know, that was it. I was hooked for life. Resident Evil, I went back and played them all and realized how perfect they are. Mm. Like, I think to this day, the two best, you know, one remake and two classic are like 10 out of 10 games. I love them. And Silent Hill 3 is my favorite of all time.
What is, for you, the scariest PS1 survival horror game? Or is there like a moment that you always remember as absolutely terrifying?
The moment I remember is from a PS2 game, and it's Silent Hill 3. And it's the mirror room. Have either of you played
Silent Hill? Yeah, well, so I was going to say, it's funny that, because I've got a similar story with you, whereas with your last question, you said that you played Silent Hill, hated it. I had that with Resident Evil.
Okay.
Played it late many years later, and I loved it. Yeah. And then with Silent Hill, I always like watched my brother play it. Sure. But what I'm doing at the moment is over the past few years, every Halloween I've been playing a Silent Hill. So this year I'm on Silent Hill 4. So okay. I literally just did Silent Hill 3 back in the October just gone. Seriously. And I do remember the mirror room, and that is a great moment.
I don't know about the mirror room. You're going to have to tell me about the mirror room because it sounds terrifying.
It's very, very simple. I think it must be in the latter half of Silent Hill 3 because I remember being fully like under the curse of Silent Hill 3 by the time I got to it. You know, I play horror games at night, lights off, headphones. I give them every chance, right? Because I want them to work. I want to be in. I want to be terrified. So I give them every chance. So yeah, lights off, sound up. And the mirror room in Silent Hill 3 is very simple. It's a death trap room that can kill you. But that's not what's interesting about it. You go in and there's a full length mirror on the opposite wall, and you can see Heather, the character. Her whole body is reflected in the mirror. And you're walking around this little box room, and the mirror is, you know, the reflection's moving with you as you expect, and you're investigating a bed, and there's some blood or whatever. And then at some point during that room, the reflection stops copying you. So, and your brain, my brain went, okay, that is now someone else.
Oh God.
You are suddenly no longer alone in this room, because the person who was moving with you is now separate from you. And my heart just like stopped. Mm. It's so powerful, so simple. I don't think anything's topped that.
Oh, that sounds terrifying.
Yeah.
That Silent really Hill does.
Really good.
I remember the moment in Silent Hill Silent Hill 3 specifically as well, where you're in the room and then like just blood starts slowly growing.
You know something bad is happening, so you're already on edge.
Yeah, like
it's peak.
You see it happening to like Heather and you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's another room that if you just leave it, you die, don't you? If you just...
Yes. I can't remember how you survive that room, but it definitely can kill you.
Mm.
So yeah, that's my favorite. That's the scariest thing I remember.
What for you is the most iconic survival horror monster?
Probably Nemesis, I guess.
Rosie's loving it.
Just because, like, the idea of a pursuer enemy is so strong. And I guess there was Mr. X in Resi 2, but Nemesis was the one everyone remembered. And he was so good because he broke the rules, because he would burst through a wall that you didn't know could be burst through.
Yeah.
So you were walking along a corridor and looking at the pre-rendered backdrops, and suddenly the wall would explode, which on PS1, back when, you know, the games were simpler... That was shocking, genuinely shocking.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think Nemesis takes the cake just because he will come for you in places that you did not expect. And he's unkillable. So, yeah, it's great.
We're seeing that quite a lot. And with increasing frequency, I think, nowadays in survival horror, that trope of being relentlessly hunted by a powerful enemy that you can't fight, or that you can maybe, you know, parry for a little bit, but ultimately you have to run away from them.
We talked about Clock Tower and Haunting Ground earlier, but those games are entirely that. There are no smaller enemies. It's just something is chasing you the whole time.
Yeah.
There's no pursuer enemy in Crow Country, but it's the number one thing on my list of things I want to do next time, because it seems really fun. to do.
If you could recreate the fear of the original Nemesis on PlayStation 1, I think that will
be... Yeah, just do that. Just recreate the fear of the most iconic survival horror monster of all time.
Yeah, easy. I'll be out.
Have you enjoyed playing, or what horror games have you enjoyed playing in recent years?
There's a lot of indie horror games that I've not played. I do like Signalis a lot. That's a very good one. I liked Alisa by... is that Casper Crowes? That's really good. That was an old school PS1 survival horror game. I really like the Little Nightmares games. And they're not like full on hardcore survival horror. They're more like horror platformers.
Yeah.
Like stealth horror platformers.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they're really good. And there's some genuinely great horror gameplay in the second one with the lights turning on and off in the hospital. They're great games. I really like them.
Some amazing imagery in those games.
Yeah.
Like really unsettling.
Yeah, genuinely
stuff.
like awful things in those games. I love them.
Mm.
And then I've been playing, you know, Resident Evil 7 and 8 and all the remakes. They're all really good. When they announced Resident Evil 4 remake, I rolled my eyes and said, "That game doesn't need a remake. What are you doing?" And then it's great and I loved it. I played it to death. So yeah. I was wrong and hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong about Silent Hill 2 remake as well.
Oh, it came full circle with Resi 4 for me. Like it was such an influential game, Resi 4.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And all of the remakes of Resi 1 and Resi 2 sort of adopting that over-the-shoulder style.
I genuinely say Resi 4 is when the modern industry started.
Yeah.
It's when the classic industry stopped. Like, there are two eras of video games, and it's pre-Resi 4 and post-Resi 4. I genuinely believe that. So, yeah.
That's a really good way of putting it, actually.
I'm not sure I could argue with that.
Like, yeah,
it really is the turning point. Because after that, everyone was like, oh, over-the-shoulder, third person, got it. And before that, everyone was like, we don't know what we're doing and do all kinds of things. I'm not saying it's necessarily a good change, but it was the change.
I wanted to end with like a fun quiz.
Oh, I should talk about my...
Between you and Rosie. But before you do that, I want you to definitely show the bag of delights, because Rosie especially
There's
is going to lose
her... There's a genuine bag of delights!
Rosie's going to lose her
I
mind.
I thought you were just using metaphor.
No, it's real.
So I'm a PlayStation 1 and 2 collector, like pretty hardcore. I have collected almost everything in the genres that I care about, which is survival horror, platforming, RPG, whatever. And I love to play, in particular, the crappy games that no one likes. My favorite thing about PlayStation 1 is that it has an endless library, genuinely endless. I don't know how it happened, but I've been collecting for years, and every year I find new stuff that I'd never heard of. It is crazy. So I've been scraping the barrel is the term, but there's a lot of PS1 horror games that are not famous that I've played and I've loved, and I have a few here. Galerians.
I haven't heard of this.
Is a PS1 survival horror by Crave and ASCII. I don't know, and it's a little bit like you play as a psychic boy with kind of evil psychic powers, a bit like Akira, and it's a bit like, oh, you are the monster kind of thing. But you break out of a lab and you can make people explode with your mind. But it's pretty traditional survival horror, honestly. Quite slow. A lot of these games are awfully slow. I play a lot of games that I love that I would never recommend to another living soul. and I have a real affinity for slow, clunky, boring games. I've genuinely taught myself to like them. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Overblood is one. Anyone ever played Overblood?
Love this one.
This is a very funny, it's mostly, I would say, adventure game, but it looks and feels like it's a horror game.
It doesn't have like that much combat.
No, not much.
No, at all, really.
You can certainly get killed in it.
Yeah.
Just like, this is a great, like, so bad it's good game where you will laugh playing it. Here's a good one that I actually love, Kudelka. So,
is that Square Enix one?
No. But it is a JRPG. So
I remember hearing loads about it.
Simultaneously horror survival and JRPG. And I was like, huh, that's weird. And it's so good. The battles are turn-based RPG, but the environments are fully horror survival, where, you know, you're solving puzzles, picking up items, unlocking doors, whatever. And it's fixed camera, everything. But then when there's a battle, it's a turn-based Final Fantasy style battle. And that works better than it should.
Mm.
This also has the best cutscenes and voice acting of any PS1 game, bar none. They're either mo-capped actors playing in the same studio together.
Oh, wow.
It is uncannily good. To this day, they're high standard. Because the characters will interrupt each other, they'll talk over each other, they'll walk around the room and push each other. It's incredible. So good. Nobody's played this. Chaos Break. Anyone play?
No, I haven't heard of this, actually.
This is amazing.
Look
that you're
at the characters on the back.
Bringing
of
out PS1 games that Rosie's not even
heard
of.
Hello, Jill Valentine, Redfield.
Well, it's not a surprise.
Just look at them now. I'm sure even from this camera, you can just see like a little silhouette of the two of them.
For anyone who's listening to this on Spotify, you've got to check out the YouTube version of this podcast so you can see all of the covers of these games.
Oh, wow. Look at that. Okay, tell us about it.
It's completely awful and I love it. It's so bad. It's the controls are bad, the combat is bad, the puzzles are too hard, but I just loved it. There's a moment where you have to do a long timed section and then there's a puzzle at the end and it's so hard. Like basically a common thread with these kinds of games is, and you're playing it and you say to yourself, did nobody test this? And the answer is probably no, especially in the latter half of the game, because I think they basically were tested, you know, the first 10 minutes. And then whoever was in charge said, yep, that's fine. So a lot of the time, the latter half of these old games is horrendous, which is great because I just love that kind of thing. So yeah, it's also a lot of Metal Gear Solid 1.
Yeah.
It has a big influence on that. So you can see the popular games were Resident Evil 2 and Metal Gear Solid 1. So everyone was like, right, we're going to do that. And then they did bad versions of those games. This is a fantastically bad game called Vampire Hunter D.
Yep.
There's an anime called Vampire Hunter D and a manga and a series of novels. And this is literally a Resident Evil 1 clone, but you play as Vampire Hunter D, who has a sword, and he's a vampire hunter. He's a Dompier, so he's half vampire. Anyway, it's, again, I loved it to pieces, but I would never ask anyone else to play it, because it's painful. It's too hard. It's too slow.
It does get to a point when you first start playing it, because I played this very recently as well.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's like, I only played it for around 2 hours or so. And I watched the film version of the anime. And, or if there's only a film, I'm not sure. But I remember first playing it and I was like, oh yeah, this is really cool. But there is that point when you're like, suddenly the difficulty just went,
it's nuts. It's nuts. They don't care about you. the industry did not care about you. They just made whatever.
Mm.
They weren't trying to appease the masses, which was, it's kind of why I love the PS1 stuff. I feel like around PS3, everything started to become kind of smoother and cleaner and more friendly. But yeah, back in the PS1 days, like, whatever. Like, if a game's too hard, it doesn't matter.
Mm.
Hell Knight, now this one's really obscure. I would describe this as unplayable. And it's...
put it on the back of the box.
Yeah.
Unplayable.
It's baffling and unplayable. And honestly, even I didn't get any joy from this one, which is very impressive.
So that's like a key factor of you liking the game. I didn't like it. I couldn't find anything to like about it. Yeah. So it's going in the bag.
Just put it back in the bag.
I am very willing to enjoy a bad game, but that one, no. Countdown Vampires, I haven't played yet, and this is a US copy, which is explains the sort of extent of my collecting is that I have a PS1 that can play any kind of game, and I've moved on to American games because I've scraped the PAL barrel. I haven't played this one yet, so I'll get back to you when I've done that. And then here is one more, The Note. This is first person, and it's you wander around a mansion as a reporter, and it's really spooky. It's a bit like Resident Evil meets Kingsfield.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's some of my... It's not even all of them, but I just brought some of the ones that you probably hadn't heard of, because... No one needs to see my copy of Resident Evil 2, you know. So,
but these are the ones that are gold, the ones where when you do find them, I love looking at YouTube videos where people have just done, you know, 10 PS1 horror games that aren't Resident Evil but feel like it, for example.
Yeah.
And that's where you do find these gems like this. Yeah. And all of them have just their little trinkets that you just love about them.
Yeah, yeah. And then with the PS1, there'll be games that aren't even on those lists. Mm. That's the thing, that no one likes enough to even put a YouTube video together. So, yeah. It's the best console for collecting because it's just endless hidden gems that aren't actually gems.
I mean, Rosie's got... You've got walls of your house dedicated to your PS1 collection.
Oh, really?
Well, we got our flat and we've got in the sort of corner of our living room area, we've got... We call it the gaming shelf where it's just a bunch of, the IKEA shelves that are just filled with loads of physical video game media, and mainly it is PS1 and PS2. I'd say those are definitely the biggest ones.
What's your rarest... thing that you've got?
Oh,
PS1 or 2?
Oh, what would I say is the rarest?
Rarest or most valuable or anything around that.
Well, we've got... So my boyfriend was the one who found... Because we sort of like share it. Mm-hmm. And he found Tumbi and Tumbi 2, which I know are famously rare.
Yeah, I would say those, yeah.
There's Klonoa, Daughter Phantom Mile, mm-hmm. which I said to him at the time, because we're trying to save money to afford to like start renting a place. And I said, you can only get a game if you find this game, if you find Klonoa for a cracking bargain. And right. to his credit, he gave me a Skype call and went, I did it. Oh, and it's fantastic. I'm so happy about it.
You call it the hunt, don't you, Rosie?
Yeah, we call it the hunt.
When you go out searching for rare games.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's fun. It's my hobby, so yeah, I'm all for it.
It's not even like rare games specifically. I remember we went on the hunt once and it was in a gaming market and I found Chicken Run on PS1 for a quid. And that was my favourite purchase that day.
Great.
Because it was a pound and it's Chicken Run on PS1. I loved that game when I was younger.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, I'm just trying to... I know there's going to be like a few right now that I'm just like, why? I'm going to finish this podcast. I'm going to be like, I should have mentioned this.
I mean, the most expensive ones are traditionally Misadventures of Tron Bonne and Symphony of the Night.
I was going to say.
Neither of which I have. I don't really mind about those ones, but they're probably at the top of the list price-wise. Also, the game where you roll the beach ball.
Cooler World.
That's
one I'm looking out for.
So expensive now. Why? That's,
every time I go out on the hunt, I'm always looking
good
for...
Good luck. I know. Because everybody has gotten wise to this now.
I remember when you could get it for like 60 quid at one point, and I should have got it back then. Because I don't even remember back then thinking that's too expensive for this game where you're just a ball doing these puzzle things. But now I'm like, why didn't I get it?
My biggest... the rarest things in my collection are probably PS2 games. I have Kuon, which is a FromSoft survival horror.
Yes, I've heard of this.
It's very, very good.
Mm.
Really, really spooky. And it's randomly expensive. I guess it just didn't get a big print run. The other one I have that I'm really proud of is Rule of Rose.
Oh my God, my boyfriend really wants to have Rule of Rose. Yeah. Specifically, he is always just like, I really want to have this game.
So it was banned in this country, which is to say it was pulled at the last second and wasn't released in the UK. The real reason it was because there was some mistranslation on some advert and everyone thought it had worse things in it than it did. But the game has animals in it and children in it, so it's a bit like, ugh. Anyway, so it's super hard to find because it only got like France and Italy print runs or something. So I just randomly got it when it was new. And I've just kept it in good condition, thankfully, ever since.
Oh my God.
But nowadays it's worth loads. So I'm really happy with that. So yeah, got lucky there.
Amazing. I love this. I love this for both of you.
Lizzie, the fact that you're like, oh, I just bought Rule of Rose at one point. I'm just here thinking, how much would that, not like, you know, not to sell it stuff. I'm just like, oh my God, how many people would love
it? It's not a very good game. It's like Clock Tower 3, but worse. But I also love it because, you know, I like bad games. So
but that's the thing with these games as well, isn't it?
The music is good though, Rule of Rose. Sorry.
No, it's all I was going to say. The games don't necessarily have to be good or bad, but as soon as people start picking up this is a rare one, they just seem to get more and more pricey.
The market's gotten crazy in the last few years. Everyone's realizing how much people are willing to pay for retro games. So I'm glad I've done most of my collecting already, I'll say that.
Fantastic. Well, we are nearing the end of our podcast, but before we go, I would like to pit the survival horror knowledge of Rosie against the survival horror knowledge of Adam and just see who wins. Now, the way this is going to work, I've got a selection of games and each game has four words attached to it that is a clue for what that game is.
Okay.
The first word I'm going to read out is quite obscure and as I go through the words, they get a little bit more obvious. So, for example, if the game was The Last of Us, the first clue could be mushrooms. The second clue could be guitar. The third clue could be apocalypse, that kind of thing. So if you think you know what the name of the game is, just shout out the name of the game.
Okay. Oh, I'm nervous. Great. I'm nervous.
And we will see who
I'm nervous
wins.
Too,
there's no pressure, Rosie. You're literally against probably
I'm excited
like
and
an
nervous
actual expert here. Okay.
There's a lot I haven't played.
I think the first one's quite easy. Anyway, here's the first word for game number one. Neptune. The second word is yawn.
Neptune and yawn?
Resident Evil 1?
Correct.
Oh.
What's Neptune?
Don't know. I didn't actually write this. But the other clues.
I don't.
Is there Neptune? Like a puzzle or something?
I know what yawn is. I don't know what Neptune means.
The other clues are sandwich and piano.
Oh, sandwich I would have got. Oh. I mean, that one's a famous one. Neptune. Sandwich.
When you said Neptune, I was like, oh, it's a Saturn game. But
I was thinking just about a space survival horror.
There are,
I was
several. Yeah,
yeah, well, I was like, which one would that be?
Well, let's blame Secret Boss. He wrote this quiz.
I'd love to know what that is.
Anyway, that's you've got it though.
Yeah,
one
nil
to Adam.
Yeah,
here we go. Game number two. The first clue, and this isn't the answer, but the first clue is Ace Attorney. The second clue is Secret Operation Raid Team.
The Ace Attorney's really thrown me there.
Detective, lawyer, Phoenix.
The third clue is Ibis Island.
Oh,
that
this is the Dreamcast one, isn't it?
That really rings a bell.
Blue Steel or something. No.
The fourth clue, you're going to get it here. The fourth clue is Velociraptor.
Dino Crisis.
Correct, Rosie.
Yay! What were the words that were?
Ace Attorney.
I was thinking Capcom.
Do like an Ace Attorney reference in the game?
No, I was just thinking Capcom. I was like, I was thinking Capcom, and then for some reason Dino Crisis didn't hit. I was like, Ace Attorney, and then I was thinking of styled games like Ace Attorney, right. And that's what threw me off.
Ibis Island is, I guess, I think it's where it's set.
I forgot that.
Dino Crisis is one I that was my favourite as a kid. I absolutely love Dino Crisis.
It is great.
Okay, so it's one all.
One all, yeah.
One all.
Got me.
I don't know if you know this game, Rosie. Adam, obviously, I don't know at all if you know this game. And these clues seem to be quite obscure. Thank you, Secret Boss. So we'll just carry on. The first clue is New York.
Oh, I know what this is. Parasite Eve.
It's correct.
I was going to say, I was like, what, there's a famous one in New York.
So New York, that game. It's set at New York at Christmas. And every location is like the New York Museum, the New York Police Department, the New York Zoo. It's the most New York game ever made. I also played it very recently, so I have an advantage.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
I've still never played Parasite Eve.
It's a banger.
Is it the one with like, there's like a big opera scene at the beginning? Oh,
yes.
Yeah, it looks
absolute
great.
Banger. Square Enix putting out, Squaresoft. Fantastic.
And it was quite an era for them, wasn't it?
Oh, they were putting out so much good stuff.
Vagrant Story has always been my favourite. Mm. Absolutely love that game. So it's 2-1 to Adam. We've got another four games left.
Okay.
So you can still claw it back, Rosie. Okay. Clue number one. Pipe.
Silent Hill.
Correct, Rosie.
Oh, like the lead pipe?
That's what I was thinking. Oh, I was like, I think that's the only survival horror where you've got the pipe.
Well done. Yeah, I was like, okay, a game that takes place in a pipe. I was like,
Other clues would have been Harry, school, and fog.
Yeah.
Well done for getting it from pipe.
That's impressive.
I think it's because every time I do it, I always have the pipe. I'm like, I'm saving like, my ammo. Yeah. Like I was saying earlier in the podcast, save that. I'm using the pipe.
Yeah. Okay. So, two all with three games to go. The first clue for this game, again, this is not the answer. This is a clue. The first clue is Clock Tower. The second clue, Brad.
Resident Evil 3.
Yes.
I know, I heard the name Brad. Brad! Oh my god, I can't believe it.
My clock tower is the best bit of that game as well.
There we go. It's 3-2 to Adam.
Well done, Adam.
Adam, if you get this next one, you are our survival horror champion.
Okay.
The first clue, Shadow Island.
Why does that ring a bell?
The second clue, dual protagonists. Clue three, Flashlight.
Alone in the Dark?
Oh, well done.
It is Alone in the Dark. Alone in the Dark, the new nightmare.
Yeah, well done. You know what? I've tried to play that game about 6 times and I fall off it after about 2 hours, but I'm aware there's a flashlight in it.
That's what I still need to play. Again, it's in my list of I need to play this
same.
One.
Like I've tried, but yeah.
It's 4-2, so there's no coming back for you now, Rosie.
That's fine. I've been having a great time.
Yeah, it's fun.
We'll do the last one anyway.
Yeah, we'll do the last one anyway.
Okay, here we go. Clue number one, Norway. Clue number two, Jennifer.
I feel like whenever there's a name that pops in, I just go, and I'm like...
Norway.
Clue number three, Scissor Man.
Clock Tower.
Oh, I think Adam just got in there first, Rosie.
Is Scissor Man in Clock Tower 3? I haven't got that far in it. I only remember playing...
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Good old Scissor Man.
Well, there's a variation on him, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, Scissor Man is the guy from the first one or two.
Yeah, from definitely in the first one.
Wait. Is she called Jennifer in that game?
No, in 3 she's called Alyssa.
Yes. But she's based on Jennifer Connelly.
Mm.
Because everybody was.
Everyone in Clock Tower is based on Jennifer.
Amazing. Well, Adam, well, thank you so much for indulging us
that
there.
That was super fun, yeah.
5-2 is the final score.
Well done.
Although you did get Clock Tower as well, Rosie.
Yeah.
So
let's split that one in half.
Split that point, yeah. I'm impressed by pipe.
Pipe.
And it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, Adam, and picking your brain and seeing in your sack of rare PS1 survival horror goodies. It's been amazing. Crow Country comes to PlayStation on the 9th of May. If you are a fan of survival horror PS1 era games, you absolutely have to check it out. It looks absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the game, Adam.
Thank you so much.
I hope you can survive this anxious limbo period you're going through now before the game comes out.
Yeah, me too.
But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And please do join us again in another couple of weeks when we have another episode of the PlayStation Access podcast. Thank you very much for watching and for listening. We'll see you again soon. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.